Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassana. I'm assuming that the majority of people here this evening are on the annual summer retreat being led by Ajahn Abhinanda, and it may have been pointed out to you already that also being the first Sunday of the month, I traditionally lead the community in a contemplation on the Dhamma verse that we have appearing on our Forest Sangha calendar. And also, the first Sunday of the month, there's a beginner's meditation class. So whatever brings you here this evening, I hope that this shared contemplation will be of some benefit. And to start with, the Dhamma quote that is on the calendar page for all of this year, teachings by Ajahn Chah. And the quote for this month is about respect, and Ajahn Chah is saying that all communities, whatever form they take, secular or monastic, require mutual respect. And without it, negligence and degeneration sets in, and they cannot succeed. And there's a photo of the community at Amaravati paying the respects to Ajahn Sumedho in a formal way. I don't remember when it was taken. Do you remember when that photo was taken?
It was the last World Amits meeting.
Hmm?
The last World Amits meeting.
The EM, 3 years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, we have our international elders meeting, we call it, where we all come together. And so we were paying our respects to Ajahn Sumedho on that occasion. And remembering, of course, that when we're reading these quotes, these are translations of teachings that Ajahn Chah gave in Thai, and so I don't know exactly what he meant by negligence and degeneration. I don't think we would disagree on the basic principle that respect is a good thing, that we all can remember what it's like, I'm sure, to feel seen, to feel received, to feel acknowledged, to feel respected. It feels good. It really feels good. And perhaps we can also remember the opposite of when we don't feel respected, we feel dismissed, we feel not seen, we feel not received, how painful that is. And on this occasion, Ajahn Chah was presumably talking to his community at Wat Pa Phong in Thailand and pointing out how this is a quality of heart worth cultivating, that if we don't, negligence and degeneration sets in. And of course, we can see that in the world that we live in, whether it's in a little community like this, if we're not behaving respectfully to each other, well, there are consequences, very obviously. In the larger community, the towns or villages or cities that we live in, if there isn't a sense of mutual respect, well, we don't have to look very far before we see signs of disintegration. And so mindful, skillful, mutual respect is a quality of heart, or we call a virtue, that's really worth cultivating. And a lot of the Buddha's teachings were about identifying these qualities of heart, respect being one of them, gratitude another one, generosity another one, forgiveness another one. Traditionally, we talk about the paramitas, or the forces for transformation that the Buddha spent many lifetimes accumulating, which culminated in the great transformation of the heart, which arrived at realization, liberation. And so identifying these virtues, these qualities, and then the encouragement, all the years he spent teaching, pointing to in various ways, this helps, this doesn't help. And so if we're aware of this, if we've heard it from our teachers and we have come to experience for ourselves in various ways how these qualities of heart really make a difference, respect, the ability to feel it, the ability to show it, gratitude, the ability to feel it, the ability to show it, forgiveness, the ability to feel it, the ability to express it. Now, if we already have this sense of the goodness, the beauty, the benefit, then how come we are not better at it? At least that's the question that came to my mind when I was reading this verse. It's time to talk on this verse. And I thought, well, how come we're not doing more of this? Why is there a dearth of these heart qualities? Now, whether it's actually the case that the whole human family is degenerating collectively, falling apart or not, I don't know. There's some signs that it seems to be that way, but maybe it's no real evidence. I think we probably would always agree there's room for improvement. There's always been room for improvement. In the time of the Buddha, there was room for improvement. Now there's room for improvement. So why don't we invest more in the cultivation of these things that help? And that's what I'd like to spend a little time considering this evening. If these things are obviously so helpful, what is it that gets in the way? I think this is an overall useful theme in our contemplations. When we're struggling in life, we know what really helps. We're all old enough to know what makes a difference. We've seen enough, we've heard enough, we've read enough to have an intuition, not just an idea, but a conviction of, this matters. These heart matters are worth investing in. And yet, if we're honest, probably most of us don't invest as much as we really want to. And so what gets in the way? And so responding to this question, we ask ourselves this question, or we're having a discussion, we ask each other this question, which direction does the mind go in when we ask ourselves these questions? And surely this is one of the characteristics of contemplation. We're asking ourselves the right kind of question at the right time and in the right way. Asking this question, what is it that is obstructing our cultivation of virtue? Or collectively in society, in young people and children, the instilling of wholesomeness, of the recognition of what brings benefit to oneself and others. What is it that obstructs that? How do we ask that question? And if I ask myself that, I recognize that there is that tendency of mind to immediately look outwards. So much of our energy is going outwards. Our attention goes outwards to seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and cognizing, through thinking. What's the cause out there? That's one way of approaching this question. What is it that's getting in the way of the cultivation of wholesome qualities of heart and mind? Why don't I manage to invest more in the cultivation of respect and gratitude and kindness and generosity? Maybe it's the way I was brought up. We could blame our parents. I didn't have the right religious values. I was fed a whole lot of wrong view, so we could blame our parents. Or we could, if you're into astrology, you could blame Neptune. What was Neptune? Neptune was, a few decades ago, Neptune and Leo was doing really beautiful things and generated the whole hippie generation. Now, that was beautiful, the music, the colours, the fashion that came out. I mean, look what Neptune's doing now. You could blame astrology. Or your genetic inheritance, what our ancient ancestors were doing out there, in the jungles. And, the brain was evolving in this fault-finding way, always looking for dangers and things that are wrong. And, our brains are wired wrongly. That's why our minds are like this. Or or plastic. It's plastic. All the chemicals in our food that's poisoning us, or globalization. Somebody was telling me the other day, it's globalization's to blame for everything. Well, what about the mass media? I mean, we could certainly, you know, they're a pretty big target. Well, anyway, so you get my point. If we look outwards, there's plenty of excuses for blaming. But, well, this is not, when the Buddha was faced with this conundrum, you know, why isn't there an answer to this complex conundrum that human beings are faced with? Tremendous potential for beauty and joy in this life as human beings, but yet we behave in ways that are very not beautiful. and not don't lead to joy a lot of the time. And so when the Buddha was faced with this conundrum, he didn't just look out. Fortunately, he looked inwards. And that's where he found his solution. That, he identified not any particular group or any religious sect or nationality or dietary deficiency or malformed astrological configuration. He came into recognizing this condition, which is called avijja, the Pali word for it, which means unawareness. Unawareness. If the mass media people were not managing to entertain the masses, they wouldn't be making money that their multinational corporations demand that they make to please their shareholders. You know, that's what these people are doing. They're making money. How do they make money? By entertaining the masses. And why are the masses entertained? Well, it's not because the masses are all bad. It's because of unawareness or avijja or wrong knowing. This word avijja, some of you will know this, the Pali word vijja, it means knowing, understanding, knowledge. Avijja is not knowing or knowing wrongly. You maybe in the Pali chanting, you would have come across that vijja jarana sampanno. We chant the qualities of the Buddha, which, if you've been to Amaravati or Chithurst, where they translate the chanting into English, the vijja jarana sampanno means perfect in conduct and understanding. I think personally it would have been better if they'd rendered it as perfect in understanding and conduct, because it's surely the understanding that comes first that leads to the expression and behaviour of body and speech. And the Buddha was perfect in understanding, in vijja, and perfect in charana, in its expression and conduct. And well, he identified this as the solution. This is what obstructs. This is what obstructs our wholehearted, embodied, thorough investment of all of our energy and attention in the cultivation of that which brings benefit to ourselves and others. It's because we don't see clearly. It's avijja, and it's like a distortion. It's like a warp in consciousness. It's not just kind of a misunderstanding. It's not just a misunderstanding. Even understanding, I'm not sure, is the best translation for vijja, because it's more profound than that. We often associate with understanding just kind of an idea. But this is knowledge. This is what the Buddha was talking about, was profound insight, profound knowledge that he himself and the great teachers have all realized and said this is a solution. And so this is surely where we want to be looking. This unawareness, this ignorance, this what you could in psychology speak, you could talk about denial. Denial is not just misunderstanding, it's a fundamental warp of the psyche where we're deeply fooled by something. We deeply misperceive something. This is what the Buddha recognized. One reason why that after his enlightenment, the Buddha was probably 2 months before he got around to teaching anybody, because he looked around and saw that everybody was just so confused. I mean, there's no point in trying to teach them because everybody's obviously so confused. There's they're doing all these things, it's creating a suffering for themselves, and then they blame other people, or they blame the outside for it. Unfortunately, after 2 months, he did come around and did give the teachings and recognize that, as the classical teachings point out, there are those with but a little dust in their eyes who, if you point out the path to freedom, then they get it. And so that's, as I was saying earlier, that's what he spent his life doing, was pointing out, this brings benefit, this doesn't bring benefit. And so this unawareness is really to our disadvantage. This denial, or this, we could also call it naivety, where we don't really grow up properly. We have naivety. I think probably to some degree all of us suffer a little bit from naivety. I know myself, I keep having the embarrassment of recognizing how naive I've been for how long. And sometimes it's painful. This Kiwi left New Zealand 44 years ago or something or other. It's taken me something like, about 64 years really, to realize how much naivety I've been carrying around with me. And on all sorts of levels, there's the social naivety, which sometimes people think naivety is kind of cute, it's kind of charming. But our naivety gets us into a lot of trouble. I've heard that that New Zealanders sometimes get themselves into trouble when they leave the comfort and security of their utterly beautiful South Pacific Islands and go out in the big wide world and come up against, there are some actually bad people out there. It's not everybody's a kind of variation on a kind of nice hobbit. You sometimes have to lock your door. Where I grew up, I don't think we ever locked our door. And the local policeman, he was just, he had a truncheon, but he was a nice guy. And I remember when I went to Sydney for the first time, I think I was 21, I had a kind of a culture shock to see a policeman with a gun, a real gun. I thought that just happened on television. And when I arrived in what was then Portuguese Timor and encountered real poverty, I thought that was just something that happened out there on television. But so there's naivety on all sorts of levels. There's social naivetes, which New Zealanders tend to sometimes characterize. But there's also in the spiritual world, which maybe some of us have come up against, the naivety that leads us to think that, we can just willfully kind of force our way towards liberation, because that's how we got around in the world already anyway, by compulsive controlling, manipulating. That's what our deluded egos do. That's what they're good at. That's what they excel at. That's what they like. The more controlling and successful we are at manipulating our environment, the better we feel about ourselves. And so we naively bring that. We can, if we're not careful, if we're not mindful, if we're not heedful, we can bring that into our meditation practice. And maybe some of you that are on meditation retreat here have that understanding already, that actually just a naive willfulness at concentrating, because we read something in a book that said that's what you have to do, it's not guaranteed to work. Just because we read it in a book doesn't mean to say it's going to work for us. That's a naive attitude. Because we learnt about something, there may actually be a correlation between when the alphabet was invented and the increase in human naivety. I don't know whether anybody's ever done a study on that, but when the alphabet was invented, human beings started getting pleased with themselves because we knew so much about things, and we can read so much about Dhamma and about meditation, and that we get all puffed up and pleased with ourselves. But then when we encounter the reality, we trip up and we fall over, and they say, well, that hurts. You know, you can read all about, you can study psychology at university and read all about projection, and you can know about projection from having read about it. But then suddenly you find yourself in the company of somebody and you're all weak and wobbly-kneed and saying pathetic things that you regret afterwards. And where did that come from? That's called projection. You just did a whole lot of it. We may have thought of, we knew about it, but we didn't know it. That's a form of naivety. And so we all suffer from this. Our unawareness expresses itself, our ignorance expresses itself in this immaturity, in this naivety, in this habit of ignoring reality. Ignorance is it's a verb, it's an activity, it's what we do, we ignore. Ignorance may not be technically a verb, but for the sake of the argument, in this case, ignorance is what we do. We do ignoring reality. Like we see a dead animal on the road, and do we stop and look at it and think, that's dead? Just maybe a few hours ago, it was running around having a good time, looking forward to lunch, and now it's, and that could happen to me. Whether I end up like that or not, I hope I don't, but I hope you don't, but one way or another, certainly I'll end up dead one day. And do we do that, or do we look away from it? That's a habit of looking away. Or if we get caught up in hatred, so painful, so embarrassing. Been a Buddhist all these years and trying hard to practice loving kindness and compassion and mudita and at least try a little equanimity here and there, and then you get all caught up in rage and indignation and anger, and you go away and you feel really bad about it. Well, that feeling bad about it, that's the message, that's the consequence, that's what's supposed to happen if we're healthy. If we're really psychotic, we don't feel the consequences, we don't get the message. We're so desperately lost in denial and ignorance that we don't feel the consequences of our actions, and that's really unfortunate. Now, a wise attitude, a wise reflection is we get caught up in hatred and we feel the consequences, is to don't be in a hurry to avoid that. You stop and really feel it. Really feel how bad that feels. Or conceited. We're all puffed up and promoting ourselves and getting carried away with, telling porkies to promote our sense of self-image. And then afterwards you go away and say, oh, God, that was pretty awful, wasn't it? And do we distract ourselves, or do we really open up and receive it? That's the work of awareness. To go against the habit of ignorance, to go against that which obstructs the cultivation of virtue. We admire these qualities of wholesomeness. We're interested in strengthening them and feeding them. What is it that gets in the way? It's this deep-seated unawareness. How do we actually grow out of that naivety? How do we wake up from that unawareness? We pay attention to the message. When it hurts, the first noble truth, four noble truths, the Buddha's teachings, are suffering. Really open up to it and receive it. So during this retreat, or those of you that are not on retreat but have a meditation life anyway, and when you find yourself, or when we find ourselves, because all of us are in this together, when we find ourselves struggling, you want to put your hands together and say, welcome. Please teach me. This is the teaching that takes us out of unawareness. This is the teaching that helps us grow out of our naivety. Something else that helps us grow out of our naivety is when we feel indignant. This is a really good barometer. Because I don't know about you, but after 40 years as a monk, 65 this year, and I still have got a lot of work to do with indignation. And I think I got taught very early on in life that it was a virtue, but I've discovered it's not, to some degree, and I'm still working on this as a project, especially that righteous indignation one. It's a real corker, that one. It really trips me up. And I don't know how you felt with the Brexit result or with what's going on over the pond there with the presidential nominees, some of the things that they're coming out with. I mean, indignation, it's easy, indignation. But what is indignation? I mean, do you imagine, can you imagine an awakened being getting indignant? I can't. I can't imagine the Buddha getting indignant. You know, surprised maybe. You know, pleasantly surprised or something. Or maybe unpleasantly surprised about how foolishly somebody behaved, but not indignant. I can't imagine Ajahn Chah getting indignant. Indignation is a sign when we were holding on to a story that we've been telling ourselves about reality that simply wasn't true, but it happened to hold us in a certain way that gave us some sort of synthetic security. You know, our struggle to find security in life means that we tell ourselves stories rather than opening up to the actual complexity of life, the utter insecurity and uncertainty of all conditioned phenomena, rather than doing the work of awareness, which means we can start to open up to all of that. Rather than doing that work, we're lazy sometimes, and we hold on to stories. We tell ourselves stories, and we stay stuck in this habit of naivety, of unawareness. So as a result of that, from time to time, reality gives us a bit of a whack, and then we get indignant. How could he say such a thing? How could she come out with that? When we hear ourselves, well, maybe if you say it outwardly, or if you don't say it outwardly, at least inwardly, maybe you hear yourself sometimes going on like that. That's good. Again, you want to put your hands together and say, welcome, this is the teaching. This is what's going to help me grow out of my unawareness. And don't expect it to always be pleasant. I mean, that's another aspect of our unawareness, another aspect of our naivety. We can think that growing spiritually is fun. And yes, I hope all of you have lots of joy and bliss and happiness and well-being, and your retreat is full of inspiration and reward. But inevitably, if not while you're on retreat here, at some stage in your life, you're going to encounter those parts of the journey that the swamps of self-doubt or the bone-breaking agony. But that's what the Buddha said when he's sitting under the Bodhi tree. You say, may my bones break or may my blood dry up. Or I get enlightened. He wasn't sitting there by the river sipping mango juice, listening to sitar music. You know, the Buddha was, I mean, this was a whole body, enthusiastic commitment, which is really what's called for if we want to awaken from our unawareness. But keeping it in balance is important. We don't want to get overly inspired by those words that the Buddha uttered under the Bodhi tree. Sometimes overly naive Westerners say, I'm going to sit here until my bones break, and sometimes their bones do break and they end up with joint replacement surgery. And you don't want to do that. It's fine to sit in a chair. And if there's not enough chairs in the Dhamma hall, ask Ajahn Abhinanda for some more chairs. You know, we want to keep this in balance, the determination, the resolve, the commitment, when we're ready, as we're ready. Remember, this unawareness gets us into all sorts of trouble. All unaware human beings trip up. And the thing is, when we do trip up, is to just see, how quickly can we remember? You know, it is embarrassing. I was reflecting recently that for every increase in awareness, there's a corresponding sense of embarrassment at how heedless and foolish I've been in my life. Yeah. But that's not a bad thing. In a way, you know, when we've got a commitment to awareness, accepting the embarrassment at our foolishness feels good. Because when you're being aware, you're not being embarrassed. You know? When you're being awareness, looking at how embarrassed it can feel to have been heedless, in a curious kind of way, you feel strong from that. Like being honest, it's like stop telling stories to ourselves that we're not heedless when we are heedless. There's another one of those very inspiring Dhammapada verses that I like quoting, verse 26, where the Buddha said that those who are foolish and confused betray themselves to heedlessness. Those who are foolish and confused betray themselves to heedlessness. The wise treasure their heedfulness as their most precious possession. The wise treasure their heedfulness as their most precious possession. Heedfulness is really beautiful. Heedfulness is really valuable. And hopefully the gradual recognition of what really matters, what's really worthwhile, what's really worth investing in, emerges in practice, but it doesn't emerge without us going through the humiliation and the feeling of embarrassment. We don't want to misunderstand that message. You know, when there's a struggle, that doesn't necessarily mean something's going wrong. You know, it's also a sign, can be the sign, that can be a symptom of the healing if we relate to it rightly. So this opportunity we have as human beings in this world at what in fact is a hugely fortunate time. I mean, never have we had so many people had such access to so much education, so much healthcare, so much food, you know, so much safety. You know, that's a fact. And it's a very fortunate time to be alive. And even to be able to ask this question, like to have the time, to have the opportunity to ask this question of what is it that obstructs the cultivation of what is really beneficial to myself and others? That's really fortunate. Yeah. Not everybody on the planet has that good fortune. So the question of how can we contribute something really meaningful, and the determination, let's contribute something beautiful to this world. Yeah. There's so much that is contributing what is not beautiful. Yeah. And again, it's not just right now. It's not like trashing this year or this millennium. I mean, when I was growing up, it was the bomb. I can remember a movie called Threads, which was an intensely frightening movie about the consequences of a nuclear attack. A really horrible feeling after watching that movie produces tremendous sense of anxiety. You know. Well, these days, I don't know, maybe they have the bomb to some degree contained. To some degree, a bomb is manageable. It can be dismantled, but we're all aware that there's this thing called global warming or a threat to our environment. You can't turn it back. I mean, everybody's aware of it. It's not something that we can just turn off. And I assume that there are lots of information out there scaring people to death about how threatening this world is, and it's sensational. And so there's a lot that we could worry about, there's a lot that really we do need to be concerned with, but we can only meet these real concerns in life if we awaken out of our unawareness, if we have a storehouse of wholesomeness, if we have a storehouse of goodness, if we know how to bring that which is beautiful into our own hearts and have something beautiful to share with others. So if I could end on that point with a wishing that all of us make the most of this significantly fortunate opportunity that we have to contribute something beautiful to our world. Thank you very much for your attention. Andamayang dhamma vadakata sadhukarang dhamma se sadhu.